Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Hey now, welcome back to the Daily Jungle. A tremendous Thursday to all of you. And probably a hell of a lot better than the one Rich Hill is having after he woke up remembering that he took a perfect game into the ninth, a no-hitter into the tenth, and became the first pitcher in Major League history to lose a no-no on a walk-off bomb. But he owned it completely, like a total boss, and you've got to respect the hell out of him for that. The Browns pick a quarterback, but it was not Brock Osweiler. And I continued what might be the greatest streak in radio history. Four Jags takes in 7 days. We also had three great guests, UCLA head football coach Jim Mora, right before the Bruins kickoff against A&M, John Morosi, who did what he does, and Saints wide receiver Michael Thomas. Alvy, back in the saddle after a day off. Go ahead and roll it. Let me start with the LA Dodgers. I'm in Southern California. Wild night last night. Wild in the sense that they don't lose. They really do not lose. So when they do, it's pretty noticeable. And last night, it was brutal. Absolutely brutal. Not just for the Dodger players or Dodger fans, but really for anybody who's got a soul. Anybody. Last September, you might recall, Dodgers pitcher Rich Hill had a no-hitter through seven, but manager Dave Roberts took him out of that game with the no-hitter intact because he had concern about developing blisters. An excruciating decision for the manager and the pitcher. It was history in the making. I mean, how many other chances is that guy going to get to throw a no-hitter? Turns out he'd get at least one more because last night in Pittsburgh, Rich Hill was masterful, ruthlessly efficient, throwing just 87 pitches to get through the first eight innings without letting anybody on base. And remember, we're talking about a guy who did not start a major league game from 2009 to 2015. If anyone deserved a Hollywood moment, it was Rich Hill. And last night had all the makings of that Hollywood moment, even down to Chase Utley picking him up with an incredible defensive play.
The 0-2 is a line drive. Caught by Utley. And Chase Utley, he looked like Superman, flying through the air, able to catch the ball and hold on to it. An absolutely amazing catch by Chase Utley.
Sportsnet LA. Every perfect game or no-hitter always seems to have that one moment where a fielder makes a spectacular play to pick up his pitcher. So when Utley did that, it was on. Hill took a perfect game into the ninth inning. Again, a guy who did not make a major league start from 09 to 2015. About to make history, potentially. He takes that perfect game into the ninth, and then this happened on the very first pitch of the inning.
For Rich Hill, he has struck out 10 batters tonight. This has been just a wonderful game by Hill. The first pitch, ground ball to third. Forsythe can't field it. By the time he picks it up, the runner is safe at first base. Well, that's the first base runner. It was a one-hopper and a very playable ball.
Yeah, he was playing even with the bat just in case Mercer was going to bunt, but you're right, Rick. That's a ball you make in the big leagues, and I'm sure Forsythe will be the first one to tell Rich Hill, I got to make that play.
He did. He did. Or he had to, because that was a pretty routine play. But Logan Forsythe playing third base in place of Justin Turner, eaten up by the ball. Don't let the ball play you. Error, perfect game, gonzo. No matter. Hill kept rolling, got out of the ninth with the no-hitter still intact. One problem. While Rich Hill was no-hitting the Pirates, the Dodgers were effectively no-hitting themselves. Well, no-scoring themselves is probably more accurate because they had lots of hits. 8 to be exact, and 4 walks, but not a run to show for it, which is why the game then went to the 10th. And then this happened in the bottom of the 10th on the 4th pitch to Josh Harrison.
Here's the 2-1, and a swing and a fly ball out to left, down the line. Granderson on the warning track, and where is it? It's gone! It disappears over the wall, and Josh Harrison wins it, breaking up the no-hitter with a game-winning home run in the 10th.
Uh-oh. Pirates Radio. Uh-oh. Perfect game spoiled by an error. No-hitter spoiled by a walk-off bomb. So not only does Rich Hill not get the perfect game, he doesn't get the no-hitter. And he gets a loss. That is a truckload of salt in that wound. But he didn't make history, though. The first pitcher in history to lose a no-hitter on a walk-off bomb. And his teammates were gutted for him. Austin Barnes, quote, it hurts. Corey Seager, quote, I really don't have words for that. It just sucks that we couldn't do that for him. You know, saying something sucks is not a take, but that sucks. That really, really sucks. Yes, he went 9 no-hit innings. So some folks want to call that a no-hitter, but it's not. And Rich Hill doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who'd want to count that also as a no-hitter. Quote, if I said that's baseball, it's cliche, but that's the way the game is. That's why it's fun. End quote. Fun. You had fun, bro. Was that fun? That looked painful. I guess not for him. In fact, not for Hill, because he's been through way, way worse in his life. And he was not looking to blame anybody other than himself. Quote, it falls on me on this one. One bad pitch. Except that I could argue that it was on the Dodger hitters who picked the worst time ever to go silent, leaving 11 guys on base when just one run at any point in the first 9 innings would have been enough for Hill to make history. But again, Hill is not going to hear any of that because he's Rich Hill.
You know, falls on me on this one, one bad pitch. Ran back over and, you know, tipped my hat.
I'm not certain it falls on you entirely.
Well, I mean, it was a bad pitch. So, you know, late in the game like that, you need to make better pitches. So tomorrow we get an opportunity to win the series. So come back and get tomorrow.
I'll tell you something about this guy. He had a chance at a no-hitter, ripped from him last year by his manager. And I know why Dave Roberts did that, and I agreed with it at the time, but the guy did have a no-hitter going. And then less than a year later, he loses a perfect game in the ninth and a no-hitter on a walk-off, and he's acting like it's really not that big of a deal. I mean, most people in his shoes would be raging or crying or freaking or all the above. He took it like the restaurant told him they were out of Earl Grey and they only have English breakfast. Look, if you're looking for Rich Hill to make it about himself, you're begging. There's no way that guy's going to do that, nor is he going to feel sorry about himself or for himself. Instead, he was just talking about Utley's play and how he had changed his mechanics or how he was going to get ready for the next game. Respect. Respect not just for the way he pitched, respect not just for the game he pitched, but respect for how he handled it after what came. Man's game, Rich. Man's game. I couldn't be more impressed. I couldn't feel worse for you, but I couldn't be more impressed. Just another interesting angle for the Dodgers in this historic season. John Morosi is back. Well, that was something last night, John. So he takes that perfect game into the ninth, the no-hitter into the 10th, and comes away with a 1-0 loss on a walk-off home run. What did you make of everything that happened in Pittsburgh last night?
Jim, so many ways to go with this story, and I think the one that I'll mention right off the top is this, that historically, this was the first time since that famed Harvey Haddock's lost perfect game 60 years ago or so, that a pitcher lost a no-hitter and the game on the very same pitch. Think about that. It's been that long. It's since Harvey Haddock's. Remarkable. Of course, that game involved the Pirates as well. But to have lost a no-hitter and the game on a single pitch, I think it was the right call, Jim, to have him in that game. I realize there's some criticism there, but I have no issue with that. He was pitching so well. He was not even that far in excess of 100 pitches. That was the right call. But so many subtle and great moments in that game. Of course, Chase Utley's diving stop on Josh Bell in the eighth inning to preserve the perfect game. I had a great text from Chris Woodward, the Dodgers infield coach, after that game, telling me that Chase was already moving in the direction of where the ball went before the pitch was thrown. Jim, that tells you that we've got all these analytics right now in the game. There is still a place for instinct. And Chase Utley, the instincts of that man on the baseball field are phenomenal. And then, of course, the ultimate hero of the game, Josh Harrison, I love his story as well. He grows up in Cincinnati, Ohio. He is the nephew of longtime Dodger John Shelby. How about that? And he wanted to play baseball t-ball when he was 3 years old. The local organizers there in Cincinnati said, Josh, you can't do it. You're too young. You're only 3 years old. But eventually they relented when they said, you know what? You need a coach for the team. Can your mom coach the team? So Bonita Harrison coaches the team. Jim, she did a great job with Josh as a ball player and as a young man because he's a phenomenal ambassador for the game. And last night, the hero in one of the best games we've seen in 2017.
John, you know it's a great game if you can get a John Shelby reference. T-Bone in there. I love
That's
that.
That's right.
Absolutely love that. John Morosi is joining us. All right, John, one thing about the Dodgers, the Hill has pitched pretty well for the past month and a half in particular. Yu Darvish is a Dodger now, but he's banged up. Alex Wood has had a ridiculous year, but he's dealing with some inflammation. Of course, you got Clayton Kershaw on the DL. What kind of thoughts do you have about that rotation right now and then how it might look in the postseason?
Jim, that's a great question because you look at the way things set up, and as you mentioned those key starters, three of the guys that we expect, three of the guys that we expect to be in that rotation right now in the playoffs are on the DL at the moment. Clayton Kershaw on the DL, Alex Wood on the DL, and again, you think about Yu Darvish, he's on the DL as well. So all of those guys, all those key pitchers for the month of October on the DL at the moment, and so there has to be some level of anxiety if you're the Dodgers about exactly how things are going to play out. Again, I still like their chances. They're still the favorites in my mind until someone proves otherwise, but they do expect to get Darvish back this weekend. Kershaw should be back, they believe, next week. He's got a minor league rehab start on Saturday. So, Jim, there's a lot to like about this rotation, but I'm with you that if you are an anxious Dodgers fan, you're looking at the way this lineup sets up for the playoffs and the postseason rotation, there are enough reasons for you to be concerned if you want to go in that direction.
John Morosi, my guest. John, Justin Verlander still out there. What is the market like for him, and do you see any chance of him being dealt before the end of the month?
Jim, I checked on this yesterday. I was told by some sources there is no real active dialogue about a Verlander trade right now. That could change. They've got basically a week between now and the roster deadline for the postseason on August 31st. But I was told, again, right now, nothing active going on. There have been talks this month between the Astros and the Tigers about Verlander. The Astros, notably, were very inactive at the non-waiver deadline back on July 31st. The Astros' record, Jim, since that time, 8-13. They have not been the same team since that deadline. Now, they should be getting Carlos Correa back in the coming days, which will be a big boost to them. But I look at their rotation, and the Astros, to me right now, Jim, they are a team that is at risk of being upset in the first round of the playoffs because of a thin rotation, I believe, at least on the back end. They could really use Verlander. But again, I'm told right now, as much of that as that may look like a great fit to us, and it's a natural place I think Verlander's going to go. At the moment, at least, Jim, I'm told, nothing hot right there between the Tigers and the Astros.
John Morosi covering lots of ground. He represents Fox Sports, NHL Network, and MLB Network. John, what about Giancarlo Stanton? He also cleared waivers. He could be traded as well. How likely is it that a deal gets done during the season?
During the season, Jim, I think it's a bit unlikely, but I do believe by opening day 2018, Giancarlo Stanton is playing for someone other than the Miami Marlins. Now, there's a lot going on here. You've got the input of the incoming ownership group with Derek Jeter, and of course, Derek Jeter's thoughts are going to weigh very heavily here. But there is a certain sense, Jim, that based on the economics of this team, the way that really it's been hard for them to generate a lot of revenue via attendance, their media revenues are on the lower side of all MLB clubs, that if the new group wants to come in and turn a profit early on, it may behoove them to move Giancarlo Stanton and also really improve their farm system, which right now is not in very good shape. So for a variety of reasons, it makes sense for them to trade someone who is chasing the very first legitimate, we think, 60-plus homer season since Roger Maris. I mean, there's a lot riding on this season right now for Giancarlo Stanton. And for me, the right teams, the teams with cachet in the game, the teams with really the name brands that Giancarlo, I believe, would want to waive his no-trade clause to play for, teams like the Cardinals, teams like the Angels, the Giants, the right teams want him, like him, and I believe that one of those teams I mentioned will find a way to get him by opening day of next year. And I really think in the near term, Jim, we should all, as baseball fans, get excited about this, about his chase for 62. He deserves it. There is no reason whatsoever to speculate anything negative about Giancarlo Stanton. He deserves a very authentic appreciation for what he's doing. And so I'm fully behind him. I think it's going to be a great story if he gets there. And I certainly wish him the best as he does it, because he deserves, I believe, Jim, the full support and interest and real, I think, adulation of the American baseball fan.
He's been on hold. He's had time to think about it, and after all, we saw what Rick in Buffalo just did. Maybe it's his day. Parody Larry. Lawrence, you're back on. Nice to have you. How are you?
Rome, thanks for the find, and I'm really looking forward to your new podcast. Longer interviews, better takes every day. There goes the sun, doo-doo-doo-doo. Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right. Hey, a few final thoughts on Monday's eclipse, total solar. So, Jim, I was fortunate enough to witness it, and it truly was a once-in-a-lifetime event, you know, like Josh and Detroit getting on the air. And did you check out the YouTube video of John and Little Rock? Hilarious. When day turned into night, there was John barking at the moon, yelling, give me back my son. And animals were all freaking out. Yeah.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
There was John barking at the sun, give me back my son. Larry, I know you were listening on Monday, Eclipse Day. And I know you had to be listening when I threw down the gauntlet and I said, whatever you do, don't call with your stupid eclipse takes and scream, give me back my son.
Give me back my son!
I said that Monday because it appealed to the lowest common denominator. It was the lowest hanging fruit ever. The most non-creative thing ever. The worst angle ever. And I knew that I would get about 250 of those submissions in the first 30 seconds of the show. This was on Monday, Larry. On Monday, I said, whatever you do, do not call me on Eclipse Day and come with some stupid take about give me back my son.
Back my
so
son.
What did you do, Larry? You came with that same take on Thursday of Eclipse Week. If that was the worst take ever on Monday of Eclipse Day, how was that going to sound and feel on Thursday of Eclipse Week? You did not just call up and call out John and Little Rock for barking at the moon and saying, give me back my son.
Give me back my son!
You didn't, Larry. You did not. On Thursday, Larry. Larry, did you not hear my intro? Did you not hear the run-up? Did you not hear me say, he's not going to do what he always does? And then you called up and you did exactly what you always do. You don't get to your parody. You give me some whack takes that don't really matter. And then you come with a give me back my son 3 days after the eclipse. And whatever you do, Larry, don't you dare come in here and say, yeah, Rome, but I called you on Monday. You didn't take my call for 3 days. I got phone lines open all week long. That's not what that is. And even if I didn't take your call on Monday, and really, Larry, I don't remember. I just don't. Because generally when I look at that call screen, and no offense, my friend, I mean, you're a good dude, Larry, but when I look at that call screen and I see your name, I really don't even see it. So I don't know whether or not you called on Monday or not. But even if you did call on Monday and you had that take then, it would have been a terrible take then. But even if you did call, wouldn't you logically think, you know, I missed my opportunity. That window slammed shut. That give me back my son call sure is not going to work on Thursday. Even if you wrongly thought that it could work on Monday. Larry. All right, let's see the first tweets through. Literally, these are not the first ones I picked or the best ones. The first ones through. Ed in Santa Paula. What the hell was that? You know what that was, Ed. That was Parody Larry.
Give me back my son.
Patrick Staffler tweets, and I'm going to read this the way it's written. No!
No!
Homie in Newport Beach tweets what I've thought many a time when Parody Lawrence calls. He tweets, bleeping sing, you dumb bleep. Larry just gets caught up. It's like a drug. He's intoxicated. He gets on the air. He quickly settles in. And never mind how many times we've said to him, you're Parody Larry. Know your brand, stay in your lane, bleeping sing. He will immediately settle in, greet me, give me some false praise, go with some whack takes, some ridiculous wars, and then and only then will he bleeping sing. I've said it a million times, you're Parody Larry, not take Larry, rant Larry, war Larry.
There goes the
smack
sun.
Larry. There goes the sun. That's getting overlooked in that. All right. I almost lost track of there goes the
there
sun.
There goes the sun. Do, 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 do.
I was so caught up in give me back my son and how ridiculous that was that I almost forgot that he started that with There Goes the Sun.
There Goes the Sun.
Doo-doo-doo-doo. Good one, Larry. There Goes the Sun and Give Me Back My Son.
Give me
Larry,
back
are you
my
trolling
son.
Me or do you really think that's good content? I mean, are you just sitting around right now? I'm going to come up with the stupidest thing I possibly can. The lamest, most logical, the most predictable thing I possibly can. You're trolling me now, Larry, right? You hooked me. You got me. You got me, Larry. I mean, that was just so terrible. That was funny. That made me laugh, Larry. You know what, Alvin? Go ahead and rack him. Save that one for posterity. There Goes the Sun and Give Me Back My Son for an eclipse.
There goes the sun. Do-do-do-do. Give me back my son.
Larry, this isn't kindergarten. This is the best sports talk show in the world, all right? I can't have that. Charlie in Goochland tweets, Larry did make you laugh, Jimmy. Everyone loves a train wreck. He did. I'm not going to deny it. It made me laugh. It made me laugh. Dan Lesks, Larry's call was beautiful, magnificent, wonderful. Signed, Sarah Jessica Bronco.
It's
Dan
so...
Lesks, I just said it. This is not kindergarten. It's Larry's call is extraordinary. It's unimaginable. It's so beautiful. Look at that.
It's so humbling.
It's so humbling.
Larry's, this is the most spectacular,
There Goes the Sun.
It's
the most spectacular, unimaginable, humbling thing I've ever seen. Larry's
it doesn't
saying,
make any
give
sense.
Give me back my son. It's
happening.
Beautiful.
Give me back my son. Give me back my son.
You know what? He's better than Max. He's better than Mad Max.
Give me back my son. Give me back my son. Give me back my son.
You tell me
son.
Who's got more fire.
Give me back my son. 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 Give me back my son.
UCLA coach Jim Moore, my guest. You shook things up a little bit during fall camp. You did not take the team out to San Bernardino. I know the players were probably a little fired up about that. What was the thinking about changing up, and do you feel like it's paid off?
Well, number one, yes, it has absolutely paid off. I think the transition to that the NCAA made where they eliminated two-a-days and just went to a one-a-day schedule for practices and allowing you an elongated walkthrough has really been a positive. We didn't go to San Bernardino for a couple reasons. Number one, the novelty of it had kind of worn off. Initially, it was a team bonding, team building, you know, get to know everybody kind of deal. Well, the way we were having to stay in the dorms up there, it was just kind of counterproductive to what we were trying to do. And then probably the most important thing is that we built this beautiful new facility, the Wasserman Football Center on our campus. And we're in it now, and it gives us everything we need to have great meetings, great practice, great resources for our players. And then we've got a new building on campus, the Luskin Conference Center, where our players were able to stay during camps. It was just all very convenient.
So you have everything right there. There's no reason to leave. UCLA head coach Jim Mora joins us. So, Jim, you come off your first losing season at UCLA, and I would imagine when you go through something like that, there's probably a couple of ways to deal with it. You can toss the tape in the trash, move on, or you can sit down and evaluate every single aspect of the program, and you did the latter. Why did you do that, and then what did you take away from the evaluation?
Well, you're right, Jim. You can decide to ignore it, or you can hit it head on, and our approach has always been to hit it head on. And I think, you know, after every season, whether you have a successful season or you struggle the way we did, you have to go back and evaluate everything. But when you only win four games and you fall far below the standards that you set for yourselves or your team, you really got to dig in deep, and you can't allow anything to go unevaluated. And so we did that. And, you know, we found some things that we think hurt us that we can transform into things that will help us. I think it all starts with culture, Jim. You know, what you believe in, what you stand for, what your standards are, and we had not done a good job last year. And when I say we, I should say me. I had not done a good enough job of creating the right type of culture we had early in our career, and I let it slip a little. And that's 100% on me. And then the things that we're doing schematically, you know, putting our players in the best position to succeed and to accentuate their positives and minimize their negatives schematically. The way we practice, we've changed the way we practice dramatically, Jim. You know, just more team periods, more competitive periods, a different energy, a different atmosphere. We've lengthened our practice. And, you know, so far we haven't kicked it off yet. You know, we haven't been hit in the mouth by an opponent yet. We haven't faced real adversity yet. But I would say up to this point, you know, 10 days out from our first game, we're where we want to be and things are going well. The key is to keep them going in the right direction and stay positive and understand there's going to be some tough days that we've got to stick together and work through.
And that first game is against Texas A&M, September 3rd, UCLA coach Jim Mora, my guest. And then, Jim, you've got Josh Rosen coming off that shoulder injury, and all the hype locally is now being directed at Sam Darnold and USC. Are people forgetting about how good Rosen is? And if so, is it a problem, or maybe do you like being in that spot, outside the spotlight, and being a little bit overlooked?
Well, I think Sam Darnold deserves the spotlight. I mean, he's a great player. He's a great competitor. You know, we all saw what he did last year. He certainly should be the leader for the Heisman this year. And they've got a great team. Josh is coming off an injury, you know, so people didn't get to see the best of Josh Rosen as a sophomore. And you know what? We do kind of like staying out of the limelight. You know, I know it doesn't help sell tickets, but I think winning sells tickets. And we don't need the hype. You know, we want to create the hype through our performance, not through people's predictions of what we can be. And Josh has had a tremendous offseason. You know, I think that was a real difficult emotional situation that he had to go through with the injury. He'd really never been hurt like that. He'd never stood on the sidelines and watched his team struggling, not being able to help. And I think it changed him. I really do. I see a different kid. I see a more mature person. I see a guy that has really stepped into a leadership role that is not resisting that at all, that his teammates have great respect for him, admiration for the way they work, and really trust in who he's become.
We're talking to Jim Mora. Now, he did attract a bit of attention recently, Jim, for that interview.
Yeah, he did.
He talked about football and school not going together. He challenged Alabama to its SAT standards. You know, this has been covered already, but my question is, do you have a problem with your quarterback expressing opinions, or is it something you embrace and encourage?
I think that I don't encourage it. I try to educate him about it, Jim. I don't think that I want to stifle opinions. I want to promote discussion as long as it's healthy. I think what's important, and let me just say this before I go any further, I don't believe that Josh was intentionally trying to throw any shade at Alabama. I think he, like everybody else, has amazing respect for him. I think he just picked maybe rather than saying a team, he should have just, you know, kind of been a little bit more general in his comments there. But here's what I encourage, Jim. I encourage these young men to think, to create opinions, to have the courage to state them, but also understand that every time you open your mouth in this time in our history with social media being what it is and instant reactions to everything that's said, that you're going to create perceptions about yourself, whether they're negative or positive, that you have to deal with, that people are going to form opinions about you, positive or negative, that you have to deal with. And so, no, I'm not going to try to stifle them. I'm not going to encourage them. I'm just going to try to educate them. And, you know, I don't have to agree with everything that's said, but I have to respect their opinion, and I do that. But at the same time, Jim, I think what's most important is that as adults, as educators, we make it clear to them what the ramifications are of speaking out publicly, and then they're learning. That's how they learn.
UCLA coach Jim Mora, my guest. Jim, take me back to the draft when your former player, Tack McKinley, absolutely went legend with the interview that he gave after he was selected by the Falcons. Knowing him as a person and everything he's been through, what was the night like for you?
Oh, man, Jim, it was incredible. You know, as you know, my career was mostly in the NFL, so I was always in the draft room at our headquarters picking a player. But to be at the draft this year in Philadelphia, experiencing it with someone just like Tack, who had overcome so much in his life, you know, from his childhood to his mother or his grandmother raising him to her death, to the promises that he made to her, and then to see his dream fulfilled, and then the emotions that were just so pure. It was incredible, Jim. It was awesome. I mean, yeah, he threw a couple F-bombs down, but, you know, they were not said in a demeaning, derogatory manner. They were just pure emotion from a kid who just, you know, realized his dream and fulfilled his promise. And then, you know, getting in the car with him after the game or after the draft, and we went to a draft party that his agent, the Tolners, put on. who are amazing, by the way, with TAC and with all of their clients, and sitting with him, and he's on his phone, and he's getting DMs on Twitter from Julio Jones and Matt Ryan and some of the other Falcons, and he's going crazy. He's just like he's reading it, and he's got a smile on his face, and he looks over at me. He's like, "Coach, Julio Jones just direct messaged me. I can't believe, And then he'd look away, and he'd look at me. He'd go, "Coach, I'm an effing first round pick." And then I'd look at him. He'd have tears in his eyes.
Wow.
And then we got to the party, and all of his relatives were there, and it was just a very. It was more of a humble, serene moment than just a joyous. I mean, sure, it was joyous, but it was like, man, wow, we did it, and to see that, that's what coaching college football is all about, is senior players go on and have success, whether it's on the field or in life. My greatest, most rewarding times are when players come back and tell me what they're doing, and they're having success, and they're happy, and they just say, thanks to UCLA.
Brock Osweiler, you are not the quarterback. That's right. It looks like the Browns are going to roll with rookie DeShone Kizer, who earned the start for Saturday's preseason matchup against Tampa. And after Browns coach Hugh Jackson stated publicly that he wanted to have his starting quarterback in place by Wednesday, well, he didn't officially commit to naming Kizer as starter for week one. The writing is certainly on the wall. It's on the wall that the $72 million man who is in the final guaranteed year of a contract that's going to shell out $37 mil guaranteed is going to be holding a clipboard.
I think this was another step in the process for DeShone. I think he's gotten better each and every week. He's showing the characteristics that I look for in our quarterback. And I thought when I went back and looked at everything and thought through it all, it was best to give him this opportunity to walk out there again. And I think he has a right to earn, the opening start by the way he plays. And I think he knows that. He's trending in the right direction.
So I guess there's a bit of a hedge there. I mean, technically, Kizer needs to show him something on Saturday in Tampa. Something like, a pulse. The ability not to get concussed. Because Osweiler has already shown plenty of reasons why he should not be the starter. Starting with the fact that he's gone two preseason games without generating a single point. Throwing up a drive chart that is two-thirds punts, one-third turnovers. And now the best part. A report from ESPN that the Browns are actively shopping Osweiler on the trade market. That's funny. That's really funny. I mean, that warrants that one. Because really, the only team foolish enough to trade for Brock Osweiler already did so 5 months ago when the Browns traded for Brock Osweiler. And even then, the Texans had to send along a second-round pick to get the Browns to take on that contract and that player. And even then, the Browns were so happy with that move that they puffed their chest and they led their press release with this quote, "We're really excited to acquire a second-round draft choice in this trade." Yeah, look, I get it. The Browns front office is feeling very good about itself right now. Their plan is to stockpile draft picks. Looks like it's working pretty well. It looks like they hit on Kizer, Myles Garrett, Jabril Peppers looks the part. And they technically haven't lost a game yet in 2017. So they probably do feel pretty good about themselves. But let's not start planning that parade just yet. Not the route. Don't break your arm patting yourself on the back. Think of how many things you'd rather have than Brock Osweiler. If you're trying to move this guy, trade this guy. I mean, you got what you wanted, a second-round pick, and you bought that pick. I mean, you paid straight money, straight cash, homie, for that pick. Now, how are you going to find somebody else to take him off your hands? Think of how many things you'd rather have than him. An STD? A subprime adjustable rate mortgage? Blake Bortles? I'm sure they've got a spreadsheet up on their wall telling Sashi Brown and Paul DiPodesta that Osweiler's worth a conditional seventh rounder and a used massage table. But don't get greedy. Slap a baseball cap and a headset on that cat and just call this a win. Don't get greedy. Don't think you're so much smarter than the other guy and you can con them into taking what you yourself already took. In the meantime, Osweiler is just trying to roll with it, trying to slip the punches, acting like it's not a big deal, that he just got beat out by a rook. He says he has no regrets. He wouldn't do anything differently.
To be completely honest with you, I have absolutely no regret on anything. From the day I arrived in April, you know, I was working extremely hard as far as mastering a playbook, studying a playbook, getting to know my teammates, doing everything I could off the field. I had a great summer preparation. I felt like I had a great training camp. So I have absolutely no regrets towards anything I've done, and I definitely left it all out there on the table.
So he's got absolutely no regrets. He wouldn't do anything differently. Fair enough. You imagine this was the guy that played for Denver and won so much that when Peyton Manning came back, he reportedly was bent out of shape that he lost his job to Peyton. Now I get that Peyton Manning was not the Peyton Manning he used to be. But he's out there and he can't throw outs and he's throwing wounded ducks. He's still freaking Peyton Manning. Brock Osweiler. Imagine a world where Brock Osweiler is unhappy that he lost his job to Peyton Manning. That's a real thing. That happened. And now he just lost his job to Deshone Kizer. But he's got no regrets. Why the hell not? He's got $37 million guaranteed. $37 million guaranteed to show up and hold a clipboard and rock a baseball cap. And he's got to know deep down that he's going to have to play again. Because Deshone Kizer plays for the Browns. They've got to protect him. Or they're going to have to run Brock back out there. We are joined by wide receiver Michael Thomas. You're coming off one of the all-time great rookie seasons for a wide receiver, second most receptions by a rookie in NFL history, and you did it in only 15 games. So when you have a year like that, the expectations are going to go through the roof. How do you go about handling them? Are you trying to shut them out, or do you embrace the expectation?
Just build. Find ways to add more value to his team. Fine-tune some things that I messed up on. You know, definitely I wasn't perfect last year. I still have a lot of room for improvement. Get on the same timing with Drew Brees, ask a lot of questions, and, you know, ultimately just take coaching day in, day out, and compete every day.
Yeah, to me, I was going to say it's a really interesting response because when you have the year that you had, it'd be easy to think, you know what, it's easier than I thought it would be. I've got this. But that doesn't sound like the way you're approaching it. Like, you want to be coached all the time. You want to learn all the time. You've been watching film, and you just mentioned you want to make improvements. Where do you want to improve? What have you seen in tape?
Everywhere. I like to improve everywhere in my game, from catching the ball to yards after the catch to putting points on the board to making the tough catches, the contested catches, to creating more separation, whatever it takes, you know, to be that guy. That's what I'm trying to do. So I'm trying to improve on all around my whole game.
Michael Thomas joining us. I know you've been working with receivers coach Curtis Johnson. Now, he's all about technique, and technicians are all about finishing routes, getting the perfect depth, using your eyes better. It sounds like a bunch of small things, but how do they impact what you do on the field? And when you're going up against the best defensive backs on the planet, do the little things add up to something much bigger?
Yes, they definitely do. He's a technician, like you said, has so much information. He's so into the details and the small things that, you know, make Sundays a lot more fun, and you create all type of separation and you get open and people are like, "Whoa, why did you do that? How did it happen?" And it's those little things that are allow you to get behind those defenders or to, you know, just beating them to a spot, all type of things. So just always picking his brain and taking notes every time he says something and asking questions. He's a great technician. I value him a lot.
Now, there's the little things, and then there's technique, but then there's brute force. Then there's your physicality. Drew Brees has said that you play with, quote, violence, and then you added 10 pounds of muscle in the offseason. So what's more satisfying, beating a DB with your technique or beating a defensive back with your physicality and with violence?
However I had to get it, I'm going to get it. To have both is always great, you know, to have both of those tools in your toolbox. But no, you know, you can't. This is the NFL. You want to have everything look the same, every route look the same initially the whole time, the whole route. That's one of the things that coach emphasizes, how to, you know, make routes, other routes look like the exact same as the other routes, so that you put the defender in sort of a bind and he doesn't know what to do. because, you know, just not giving away anything, no false movement, and making everything look the same. So having playing with physical is a blessing. You know, I use that to my advantage, but I also like knowing those little things, and sometimes those little things people don't take advantage of.
Saints wide receiver Michael Thomas joining us. You know, you're already a number one. In your second year, you're a number one receiver. I'm wondering, does that change anything in the way you approach things? For instance, do you feel like now you're the leader of the receiving core, or does being the number one receiver not really change how you approach your job?
Ultimately, at the end of the day, being a number one, number two, number three in this offense, you know, at the end of the day, the main goal is to do your job and do your job at a high level and execute at a high level. So every time I touch the field, if I'm the number one, I draw some attention, and I have to clear out to help other guys get open and help this offense be successful, whatever I have to do. And whatever my job is and whatever the coach is asking me to do is ultimately what I'm going to do, whether I'm number one, number two, number three. But if I'm that guy that has to, you know, be the spark for offense and, you know, maybe make a big play to get the momentum going or juices, I'm going to be that guy. And I like being put in those type of situations. So, you know, whatever Coach Payton asked me to do and my receiver coach and offense coordinator asked me to do, I'm going to just do that to the best of my ability and compete.
We're talking Saints.
Win games and put points on the board.
Talking to Saints wide receiver Michael Thomas. Now, last year when you went up against Seattle, you wanted the challenge of going up against Richard Sherman. Why was that something you wanted, and what was it like to go up against him?
I mean, at the end of the day, when you go against guys like Richard Sherman, all pro, a guy that played this game for a long time at a high level, you want to get your respect too. You want to show people that you could play this game. You want to take advantage of your opportunities, and ultimately, I know the coaches and everyone here believed in me, so I just had to finish the job and do my job and help this team win a game. So, I mean, I never back down for a challenge. I love it. I love competing. I love going against the best. That's the only way you're going to be able to tell how good you are. So, you know, when I get put in situations like that, I try to respond at a high level.
You know, you're determining right now how good you are. Ultimately, how good do you want to be? How good do you think you will be when it's said and done?
You know, day by day, getting 1% better. And I would say the sky is the limit from there. I don't really try to look too far or too much ahead. I might get too much ahead of myself. I just try to come out here every day and get better and not make the same mistake twice and, you know, make plays for this offense to move the ball and be in the right place for Drew Brees when he needs me. So ultimately, I want to be that guy. I want to be great when it's all said and done, but I also know that I have a lot of room for improvement. So I'm not really looking too far ahead. I'm keeping my head down and just grinding and learning from my mistakes.
Before I let you go, last spring you were drafted out of Ohio State. You end up coming to a situation in New Orleans where you're playing with Drew Brees. From a receiver standpoint, what's it like to work with Drew Brees?
Oh, man, it's everything you could ask for. It's like a dream come true to have a guy like that who's so consistent, who's comes to work every day, he's the same person every day, who competes at a very high level. It's just like he's that guy, that alpha dog that you could just look at and you could see it in his eyes, you could see it in the huddle, like he's here to win and you could see how competitive he is, and it kind of is contagious. So, I mean, I love playing with him, and it's almost like, you know, you just want to take advantage of having a guy like that behind center because not too many people had that opportunity.
You know, finally, it's one thing to be a quarterback and a vet and to watch him do it, but what about his process? What about his approach? Do you find yourself kind of modeling the way he goes about his business? And what are some of the things that you've seen that maybe you've incorporated into your own approach?
Definitely, definitely. He's not a guy that makes excuses at all. You know, he plays with the edge, you know. He's not perfect, but he's damn near perfect. He's just a guy that he handles his business. He doesn't really yell, or he doesn't ever get out of character. He has great composure. He competes. I just like everything, his whole makeup about him, how he goes about the game. I just love it. And I watch him every day. So no telling what exactly I pick up from him, but I pick up a lot of things every day. Just how he studies film, how he wants you to be here at this time, how he's looking at the defense, and just like everything about him, honestly.
Michael, I guarantee people are listening right now and they're thinking, wow, like, I knew this guy could play, but I didn't know there was that much to him, right? I didn't know that was his thought process. And I guarantee people would know even more about you if they followed you on Twitter. If they wanted to follow you on Twitter, what is your handle and how do they find you?
It's at CantGuardMike on Twitter and Instagram, so they could find me there.
Let's find out what Rick in Buffalo is thinking. Rick, what's up? Welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Jim. Thanks. How are you doing?
I'm great. Everything's good on this end.
Good. Yeah. First, I want to say thanks to the Jags making Bills fans feel just a little bit better about the upcoming season. And, Jim, thanks for letting me back in after last month's debacle. I do want to say I agree with everything the Bills have been doing lately. Doug Whaley and Rex Ryan left the franchise in complete ruins, and a total rebuild is the only answer at this point. And I can't fault Anquan Boldin for double backing and calling it quits. But I can't fault him for saying the reason was so he could channel his inner Nelson Mandela. Shoot us straight, Anquan. You abandoned the sinking ship. Trust me, we all wish we could do the same. The only thing Bills fans should be rooting for this season is that the Patriots run the table. Maybe a perfect season will finally convince Brady to retire and give the rest of this division a friggin' chance. Now I got to be truthful, Jim. I can't get enough of the downfall of one Tiger Woods. Anyone so arrogant and condescending when he had everything deserves to lose it all. And I won't be completely satisfied till I turn on the TV and see live footage of old Eldrick slumped over in a back alley, drooling all over himself. Please, Lord, make it happen. And lastly, Jim, I'm no MMA fan, and I haven't followed boxing since Mike Tyson's glory days, but I'll definitely be tuning in Saturday night. And the only thing I want to see is Conor McGregor land that one kill shot. My philosophy on this is pretty simple. Anyone who beats a woman deserves to have his face caved in. Ward Trapper winning his battle with cancer. R.I.P. Dave in St. Louis, not Hunter. Thanks to the Vine, Jim. The long road to redemption has officially begun. I'm out.
In a way, it has. Rack him. Thanks so much for listening. And another reminder, stay on the lookout for the brand new Jim Rome podcast. It drops next Tuesday on iTunes, Google, and anywhere else that you download podcasts. Until then, have at it. Hit subscribe, tell a friend, and trust the podcast. Check back tomorrow for more Daily Jungle.